This is The Feed, York Region's only news magazine dedicated to the issues, events, and stories that matter to all of us who live and work here.
This is The Feed, York Region's longest-running and exclusive news magazine. I'm Ann Romer. Welcome. On the show, eclipse watching in Kingston, setting financial goals, and PFLAG's lawn sign campaign. But we begin with the Princess and the Cancer conversation. Last month, Kate Middleton, the Princess of Wales, stunned the world with her announcement that she has cancer. Her words, her video, had a profound impact on Canadians, especially those who are battling cancer themselves. April is Cancer Awareness Month. Thanks to Princess Catherine and even to her father-in-law, King Charles, awareness surrounding cancer, at least in this Commonwealth country, is at an all-time high. Sandra Krukel is Executive Vice President, Mission, Information and Support Services, Canadian Cancer Society. She is our guest now on The Feed. Thank you for joining us, Sandra. It's such an important discussion.
It is, and thank you for inviting me.
What was your reaction and that of the CCS when Kate Middleton made her cancer announcement?
Like every other person, just a sadness that she's been affected by cancer. It's a very stressful process. I can only, you know, given our experience at the Cancer Society, we know just getting to the point where you have the diagnosis and learning that information is so stressful, and then beginning treatment. And when somebody is young, as the Princess of Wales is, you know, you think about the fact that she has kids, a young family, and the many other responsibilities and public nature of her role just adds, you know, so much to what she has to cope with. And so I think, you know, I, like everybody else, just felt sadness for her that she finds herself in this situation.
We all feel that way, I think. And it's interesting, when King Charles announced that he has cancer and was undergoing treatment, there was certainly sympathy and understanding and compassion from people around the world. But the impact of Princess Kate, of Kate Middleton's announcement, it was so different. It was worldwide shock and then sadness, as you mentioned, but the impact on Canadians was quite profound.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that she delivered the message through a personal video was really striking. It made the message very intimate and personal for her to share with all of us. And, you know, you could see the emotion on her face and in the words that she was delivering. And that made it very personal and real. And the fact that she is young, I think, also just makes it hard for us to comprehend that she is indeed facing cancer.
And I think a lot of people who are facing cancer also felt that they weren't alone. If Princess Kate has cancer, you know, whoever's listening to her message, they have cancer, they feel that they're not alone. They feel maybe comforted by the fact that she's sharing her cancer journey.
Yeah, and that was a really powerful moment in the video when she said that at the end. And my feeling when she said that was just, it is so true. It is the message that we also want to share with people, that you aren't alone. This is a very difficult and trying time, but there are other people out there, your healthcare community that is there to help you, your friends, your family, and then community organizations like the Canadian Cancer Society that have services that are there to support and guide you through a stressful time. And when a public figure like this says something about their personal diagnosis, it just raises the profile of the issue so that it is something that we can all talk about, which does contribute then to us all feeling like if we're in a circumstance, we are not alone.
And she explained as much as she could about the treatment that she would be undergoing. Does that also help people who are undergoing treatment? Because I know it can be very difficult for individuals going through chemotherapy and other treatments in order to battle cancer.
You know, it is chemotherapy and surgery and radiation are the most common treatments that people are familiar with. So it is helpful to just hear that those are the types of treatments that other people are receiving as well, if you are in that situation. And I think it's useful to know that somebody also found that difficult and challenging news to accept and learn. It helps to normalize that these things aren't easy, but that there is hope. You know, there's a way forward. There's support.
It also shows that cancer does not discriminate, that's for sure. It's a tough battle, but it's one that we are going to try to continue to win. Let's talk about age. A lot of people were very, very surprised that someone so young, and we're starting to see statistics around the world and here in North America indicating that more and more often young people are facing cancer.
There are certain types of cancer that are more common in people that are younger, like breast, thyroid, melanoma, and colorectal cancer. They're the most common in people who are over 50, but they do also happen in people who are younger than 50. And that, you know, that is concerning. Those are stats that we continue to keep an eye on. It's important to observe those trends. We don't always know why that is happening, though, and that's part of the challenge, is understanding why cancers are happening in people under 50 more frequently in some cases.
Sandra, would it have been helpful had she explained exactly what kind of cancer she has?
You know, I think cancer is such a private, your health in general is such a private matter. It's important for somebody to just really express what they feel is they are ready to express. And to express more than that is not certainly not helpful for them and not necessarily helpful for other people. I think, you know, we've heard enough to know that she's got cancer and that she is younger. And that in itself spurs on the dialogue and the conversation about, okay, cancer could be a risk that, you know, you face at any age. And what are the things that I can do that can help reduce my risk of being in a similar circumstance? And if you are in a younger age group, just knowing that somebody of profile like the Princess of Wales has expressed this does contribute to, as we were talking about earlier, not feeling alone.
Have you seen that reaction from people in Canada that they're thinking, well, what can I do to prevent this from happening to me, if at all possible? Has that been one of the outcomes of her announcement?
I don't have any specific data to say that that is an outcome, but it certainly, I mean, we've all been talking about it in the media and amongst our social circles. So that in itself raises the profile. And in my experiences over the years, anytime any of us are touched in some way by somebody in our circle getting cancer, and when it's a public profile, a person of public profile, we all feel like we know them a little bit, it does promote that internal question of, okay, this is real, what can I do? And to think about screening, that's always one of the things that comes up for most people when they learn somebody in their circle has cancer.
And as we continue to analyze the video, and she said a great deal in that video in a very short bit of time, one thing she talked about was needing to help her young children understand what she was going through, and she needed that time before making the announcement, and then needs privacy as she continues her battle and also helps her children. How important is that message?
I thought that those were such wise words as she shared them, and I can only imagine how complicated it's been being the public figure that she is and the speculation that was going on to take this time to be private with her children. But that is so important. This is the kind of information that you have to think really carefully about how to share with your kids so that you support them, so they are not afraid, so that they know you're there to look after them still and care for their needs. And it's not an easy dialogue for any parent to have, because depending, of course, also on the age of your children, they understand different things about cancer and what it is, and they could have heard different things, you know, on the playground, at school, in different settings, and have had some exposures that make them worry about things that may or may not be true, or may not happen. And you need time for that dialogue and privacy and space. So I'm very glad amidst all the pressures that she was able to find a way to do that. And it was a great message to other parents who are facing it, that it still is a private family matter that you need to to pay special attention to the communication with children.
Sandra, April is Daffodil Month, Cancer Awareness Month. What should we be aware of this month, and do we have room for hope in this battle against cancer?
There is absolutely lots of room for hope. I think one of the messages in Kate Middleton's video was also that of, you know, community and not being alone, as we've talked about, and that is a great message of hope. There are so many people, really. It takes a society of people around somebody with cancer, and we have that. We have medical professionals. We have researchers that are doing research that is continually looking to improve outcomes, and we have systems of support, like programs and services offered by the Canadian Cancer Society and other organizations, and we have friends and family, and that's part of the message of hope. The other part that I would say is we've made tremendous advances over the years. And, you know, today the risk, 64% of people diagnosed with cancer survive 5 years or more, and many people survive, 10, 20, 30 years. In the 1940s, that was just 25%. So that's a tremendous improvement, thanks to research, thanks to better early detection of cancer. And we're just continuing to move in that direction. So it's important to keep investing in research in Canada and around the world, and important to keep providing that community of support through healthcare and community services, because there's 1.5 million people living with and beyond cancer in Canada. So that's a lot of us that are dealing in some way with this disease.
Sandra Krukel, thank you. Thank you for the work that you do, and thank everyone at the Canadian Cancer Society for all that you do to try to make life a little bit easier, a little bit more comfortable, and to help us deal with this cancer, whether you are somebody that has been diagnosed with cancer or you love or live with somebody who has cancer. Thank you for what you do.
Oh, you're very welcome, and thanks to everyone who is a part of that support network for people with cancer.
April also marks Be a Donor Month. Tina Cortez now with the communities coming together to advocate for organ and tissue donation.
Dr. Andrew Healy, Clinical Medical Lead, Donation, Ontario Health, Trillium Gift of Life Network, thank you for joining the Feed News Magazine.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us about Be a Donor Month.
Be a Donor Month is in April, and it's an opportunity for all of us to make our wishes known about organ and tissue donation to our families and to register our consent for donation online at beadonor.ca.
Okay, so you talked about having that conversation. How do you have that conversation about one's wishes when it comes to organ donation?
This month, the emphasis is on having that conversation before you're in a critical situation. So in our own lives, we don't like to think about when we die. But one thing that we can do for our families in the event that we die is make our wishes known. And we think about things like what our funeral might look like or other things, but we don't often think about what we would want to do in terms of organ and tissue donation. And this is an opportunity this month to say, that's what April is about. It's about making sure that my family know that in the event I die, I want to be able to donate my organs and tissues and save up to 8 lives through organ donation and enhance up to 75 other lives through tissue donation. There's 2 really important things to do when that's your wish. The first is to tell your family, because they will be asked at the end of your life. And the second thing is to register your consent on beadonor.ca. And that alleviates from them something else that they have to think about at some of the most difficult times in their lives. So it's a gift that you give in advance and hope they never need to use. But that in the event that you're in that circumstance, that rare circumstance of being able to donate organs and tissues, they know what you would have wanted.
Thank you for sharing that perspective with us. You also mentioned organ donation and tissue donation. What's the difference?
Organ donation is a rare opportunity that happens when people die often within an ICU setting. They are able to donate their heart, their lungs, their kidneys, their pancreas, Sometimes their small bowel and their liver. And when they do that, they are able to give that living organ to another individual who is waiting on the waiting list with organ failure. And tissue donation is where you can give the gift of tissue donation in many other circumstances. You don't only have to die in the ICU. And the ability to donate your tissue can affect up to 75 lives. And, you know, tissues that can be donated include heart valves. So sometimes we need heart valves in order to help smaller children or adults who need heart valves, heart valve surgery. The most common tissue is a donation of your eyes to give the gift of sight. And you can give bone and skin as well. Skin is a life-saving donation that occurs that helps people who have had burns and need skin replacement to prevent infection. And bone and tendon donation obviously can help reconstruct surgery, or can be part of a more advanced operation where that important bone is available to help the surgeons in difficult orthopedic surgeries.
So let's talk about that waiting list. Can you describe the need here in Ontario?
We will never meet the need of every recipient on the waiting list, but we have seen a reduction in the waiting list over time. We now have over 1,100 people on that waiting list waiting for a life-saving organ transplant, and there are thousands more who would benefit from tissue donation. The waiting list is a complex place to be. Those people are quite sick, and they have organ failure and need a life-saving transplant in order to continue to live long and productive life. And, you know, those people who are on dialysis who are waiting for a kidney, the people who have liver failure waiting for a liver transplant, those people with lung disease who need lung transplant, heart failure need heart transplant, you know, diabetes needs pancreas transplant, and sometimes who have had bowel surgery and need a bowel transplant. So you could imagine how sick you would have to be in order to need an organ transplant. We will never meet that need, but what we want to be sure of is that we fulfill people's wishes at the end of their life and make sure that if the opportunity to give another person life is what you would want, that you communicate that to your family and register your consent so that those wishes are carried out for you at the end of life, and we can help those people on the waiting list. It is a rare opportunity to be able to donate organs, and we want to make sure that if that is your wish, that's well communicated well in advance.
You said that a donation can save, transform, and enhance lives. But what is the support actually like? Does it actually translate into those who register to donate?
In Ontario, if you were to survey the population, the general statistic that we usually describe is that 90% of Ontarians support organ and tissue donation. That's countered by only 35% of those Ontarians having registered their consent online. That means about 4.7 million people have said they've registered their consent out of about 13.2 million eligible health card holders in Ontario. You know, this is a very difficult time for people at the end of their life, and for the patient who is dying and for the families who are at their bedside. And for what is remarkable to us is the ability of families to make those difficult decisions as if they were speaking for their loved one, sometimes in circumstances where they don't know what their loved one would have wanted. And they are able to take that most difficult day of their lives and recognize that there isn't anything else to be done for their loved one, but they're willing to provide that gift of life to other people. And that generosity in my own critical care practice, in my own clinical practice, is something that I have an enormously deep respect for, to see people make very good decisions for their family members and to have really considered what they would have wanted in their life, despite the grief and difficulty that they're undoubtedly experiencing when they're losing their family member.
Dr. Healy, thank you so much for your time and your dedication and your focus for this project. If our listeners want more information, where can they find it?
We want them to go to beadonor.ca. That website has the information you need and the ability to register your consent directly.
Thank you again for your time.
Thank you very much for having me.
Jim Lang is next with a first-of-its-kind gender-affirming health clinic helping York Region's transgender community.
Thrilled to be joined by one of my favorite people, the CEO of the CMHA York Region South Simcoe, Rebecca Shields. Rebecca, how are you?
I'm well, thanks. And it's great to talk to you about this exciting announcement and this wonderful service.
The Ontario Trillium Foundation Fund is investing $200,000 over 2 years to the CMHA York South Simcoe. Just for the listeners who maybe don't understand, what exactly is a gender-affirming health clinic in the region? Why is it so important?
We have a few and a percentage of our population who aren't gender diverse. They may feel that they don't identify with the gender that they were born in. And for some folks that are either questioning that or they are sure, there's often this expression that when the siren calls to be authentic to who you are, you need to act on that. And there is such stigma and confusion and concern about people who are different, that they often feel isolated. Many youth get kicked out of their homes. If they're young, people who are adults may lose their partnerships. You know, they can feel really isolated and alone in this experience of feeling like their physical body doesn't reflect the true identity of who they are. And that can cause two things. First of all, it can cause serious stress and concern and a breakdown of their mental health and well-being if they're not supported. And two, should they choose to want to explore moving toward the identity that they identify as, they need support to do that. And our gender-affirming health clinic does both. Number one, it meets people where they're at. It allows people who are exploring to have that conversation. Sometimes we have young people and their families, and of course we serve ages 16 all the way up to adults, or adults come in and they want to understand what it means to them and receive the counseling and support to manage their mental health and well-being, and also learn what it means and get supported if they want to begin to live in the body that more suits them. And that could include hormone replacement therapy. It can include using a binder, all the way for us making referrals to surgery and other steps that they may choose.
And we've just seen some recent comments from Canada's own Elliot Page about the challenges of what he's gone through. And I can only imagine that's a notable celebrity with a lot of resources behind him. And imagine an average family, York Region, they need the help that your service provides.
You know, I want to take it down to a story. You know, we had a young individual, somebody who identifies as a woman, in her young 20s, who had been homeless, been kicked out of her home because she didn't feel that she fit in, had, in the experience of homelessness and the stress, had lost employment, you know, had began, maybe using some substances to try to cope, feeling very distraught when she showed up at the, and got referred to the clinic, and said to us, I don't think I'm going to be alive. And in fact, the people who identify as transgender are 7 times more likely to die by suicide than other populations, and they're more likely to end up homeless and isolated. We began working with her, supported her in her transition, supported her in managing her own mental health. Anyway, she's doing just fabulous. Back in college right now, employed and living on her own and excited to start her own career in social work. So it's amazing, you know, what people just need support and connecting to other people that are like them and building their own community.
Speaking with Rebecca Shields, the CEO of the CMHA York Region South Simcoe, talking about their gender-affirming health clinic, first of its kind in the region and the area, and thanks to the donation from the Ontario Trillium Foundation. And Rebecca, this is one of the reasons I'm so thrilled to talk to you, is try to separate fact from fiction these days through the internet, through social media, is very difficult because no one really understands what's going on except for professionals like you and your staff.
Mm-hmm. And my team is so dedicated. You know, we started off this program back in 2017 with just a couple of hours a week, and now we're 4 days a week, and with this amazing support from Trillium and other donors and philanthropists who have made this happen, we're now able to expand our care. Look, this is something about people's very personal identity, and it is not something that people choose lightly. It is something that, you know, raises great consideration of how do we live our authentic selves. And many people go through complex understandings of who they are. It takes time, and they need somebody to help work with them, to understand them, to meet them where they're at, to support them in living an authentic life. And I think that's what we all want. We all want to be the best version of ourselves and be supported. And the reality is, for people who are transgendered, it's very hard to receive care. Many family doctors will say to us, you know what, I don't know what I'm doing around hormone replacement therapy. We really want experts to support them. So, you know, we can help people with hormone replacement therapy, and then we can work with family doctors who are willing to take on these patients and, you know, help understand the medication. And then alongside any other normal primary health care concerns that somebody might have, you know, so sometimes it's just educating, because it is not a huge portion of the population that choose to do that. It's about 1-2%, but that's still enough people that deserve health care. That meets us where we're at.
But Rebecca, they're human beings. We have a moral obligation. It doesn't matter what you think. We have to help them.
Well, that's the beauty of Canada, isn't it? Is that we all belong, and we have universal health care, and this is part of universal health care. And it's access to primary care. It's access to counseling and support. You know, nobody should have to suffer because they feel that, you know, they want to live their authentic selves. And the thing is that with support, they do amazing things. And that's what we're here to do at CMHA, is believe that every human being, regardless of their identity, regardless of their culture, their religion, their 2SLGBTQ status, that they are entitled to live a meaningful and productive life. And that's what we're here for, and that's what we believe in, and that's why this is so important to us, because people who have these really things where there's so much stigma and so much misunderstanding and so much fear, and I don't know why, but, you know, so much fear, that we're there to support them and let them know that they are worthy and they belong and they deserve the same health care as anybody else.
Rebecca, earlier you alluded to the age range beginning at 16, and that's a big debate across North America, is the age, the beginning age. Is this an age, the 16, that cutoff line, is that a provincial age or an age set forth by you and your staff in the organization?
This is an age where we accept people into our program and services. We're not the only ones. Sick Kids has gender-affirming services as well. There are very much differences, and you have to have pediatric specialties. And so we make sure that people, if they come to us who are younger, where we can, we refer them to the experts at that age, because there's different complexities. So we ensure that. We know that there are young children that definitely early on identify as not being in the gender that they're born. And of course, should they come to us, we work with our children's mental health partners, with the schools and everything else to refer them on to ongoing care. But for us to begin to have those dialogues and to be able to provide treatment, we accept referrals at 16 and up.
And this is the thing that we need as a society to educate ourselves. And that's why what the work that you and your staff do at CMHA York Region South Simcoe is so invaluable. Because I'll freely admit, Rebecca, I mean, I'm learning all the time. And every time I speak to someone like you or somewhere else, like, you don't know what you don't know. So at least with these kind of conversations, you're helping us be dragged into this modern era.
It's so true. And, you know, there's a rich fabric to humanity, really. That's really what I want to say. There's a rich fabric to humanity, and all of us make humanity and inclusive communities of belonging special. And whether or not, as I said, different cultural, religious, or cultural backgrounds such as 2SLGBTQ, we all belong. And so for those individuals, you know, it's so, what I said, it's such a feeling. It's almost like a siren's call. Like, they suppress it, because they know that sometimes when they come out as transgender or non-binary, that the people around them won't understand. They are afraid of losing their families. They're afraid of losing their homes. They're afraid of losing their jobs. They're afraid of being teased at school, being bullied. And they get isolated. They feel like they have nobody to belong to. And that's where, when somebody is at that low point and yet feeling that often really terrible things happening, where they think that they would be better off dead than feeling like that they can be who they are and be themselves and be loved and supported for exactly who they are. And isn't that what we all want to and deserve, is to be loved and supported for exactly who we are? Often, and if we talk to our partners at Blue Doors and 360 Kids and other places, you'll see that, you know, they have a high percentage of representation of youth and adults that are homeless because of being 2SLGBTQ and feeling that they aren't accepted and loved by their families. And so we need to tell them that they belong, and we need to connect them with a community of friends and other support so that they can, you know, have a wonderful and life that they deserve and a meaningful life that they deserve. And that includes the counseling support, but it also includes really good primary care and hormone replacement therapy if they choose to go down that route, or even for those that are female to male and they want to use binders, you need to learn how to do that. You know, some people do things on their own with tents or bandages, and they can cause a whole bunch of problems. So you come and you talk to our nurse practitioner, we can help fit people with a proper binder, we can help people understand how to use them safely so that they don't hurt themselves in the process. We don't want anybody taking, you know, drugs that they're buying without being prescribed by a nurse practitioner, how to use them properly. All those things are really important for people who are going on that journey and exploring living in a body that fits what they truly believe that they are.
That's why you're the CEO. Rebecca, awesome as always. Thank you so much. I really appreciate your conversations.
Thank you so much.
Okay, this was the eye-catching media release headline. It read, "Call to action, support our trans community with our lawn sign campaign." Here to explain, and there are many layers to this, is PFLAG York Region's President Tristan Kuhlman. Welcome to the feed, Tristan.
Thank you for having me, Anne.
So what exactly is this community call to action, and why now? What is at issue?
Over the last couple of weeks and months, you know, we've seen anti-trans rhetoric being espoused and shared across our country. And you know, we see it in New Brunswick, we see it in Saskatchewan, now coming up this fall in Alberta. And folks across the country, just because this is happening in other provinces, doesn't mean that folks locally aren't impacted by that or fearing what might happen here in Ontario and what that might mean for, you know, possibly a federal election and a change of government next year. And so we wanted to call our community to action because there's a lot of disinformation being shared out there right now. Everyone, at some point, if you don't know a trans or non-binary person, you probably know someone who knows someone. And we're looking to use our Lawn Signs campaign to generate conversation about the pieces of disinformation that are out there and really just bring these conversations back to reality.
And what are you talking about when it comes to disinformation? And how does it affect someone who is trans?
There's a lot that's being used to justify policies nowadays, you know, especially with the policy outlines that have been shared in Alberta. You know, some of those policies having to do with restricting surgeries for folks under the age of 18, and that gives the impression that there are surgeries, gender-affirming surgeries and body shaping that's happening for folks under the age of 18, and that's not happening. There isn't a medical practitioner in Canada that will approve that. So pieces like that, we're looking to just realign the conversation, because if a policy is coming out that looks like that, then it generates the idea that it is happening when it's not. And that can create fear amongst people, fear that's really unnecessary.
And let's talk about the Lawn Sign campaign. Why would you choose this? We're in a day of heightened social media. Why something as basic as a Lawn Sign campaign?
Sometimes you got to get back to basics, and signs can be catchy, signs can be thought-provoking. You don't see them nowadays, and so that's why we went with them, because we thought, you know, what a great way to make sure that this is as visible as possible. Everyone's got social media. Everyone's got a Twitter feed. We'd love for people to disconnect from social media and connect with their neighbors in person and diversify just the you know, their own research out there and have the conversations one-on-one, because the information that you're getting online and sometimes from our elected officials is just not correct.
Here's an example of some of the lawn signs, what they say. Protect and defend trans kids year-round. Support trans youth. And here's the one that almost brought me to tears, Tristan. Trans kids deserve to grow old.
what we're really trying to target with that sign in particular, and it brings me to tears as well as I'm speaking with you, Anne, is that there's policies that are being created right now in Canada or are being tabled that really target a trans youth's ability to survive and to thrive and to access affirming spaces. And trans youth, they have the largest suicidal rate, suicidal ideation rate within our community, up to about 65% or higher in some communities. The homelessness rate as well is just appalling. And though this is a small percentage of our whole population in Canada, every child matters. We are all connected with that campaign. Every youth matters. Every trans youth matters. And it's important to look at what the policy changes are doing and how they impact youth and how they really impact their future.
So the Lawn Sign campaign, let me ask you this. Are there risks involved for those who proudly plant the signs on their lawns?
There certainly is, and we're not going to shy away from that conversation either, because it's important to call out just the blatant discrimination that's out there nowadays. Now, we're aware that when people put a lawn sign up like this, as they would any other sign that might be politically charged, you might expose yourself to vandalism, and that's the reality. But that's unfortunate for where we are today. The fact that that is something that we have to learn or to consider and to, and some folks might be deterred from the lawn sign campaign as a result, that, I think, speaks to what people want us to do, or perhaps what the other side in more extreme cases want us to do. They want us to hide, and they want us to not have these conversations because this doesn't align with the culture and with the Canada they would like to live within. Well, you know, sorry for them. Our Canada is certainly a lot more diverse, and everyone here deserves to, you know, have that access to an affirming future and a loving family and loving spaces, and that's what this Lawn Sign campaign is all about, and we hope people really resonate and connect with that message.
Tristan, you make headlines often, you personally and PFLAG York Region as well. Where does that passion for this and your commitment to this, where does that come from in you?
It's just about doing the right thing, and, you know, for me, I'm not a trans person. I'm a gay man, but in this case and in this particular conversation, I'm an ally, and I'm really only doing what I would want, you know, my friends and family to do for me if this were an issue about, you know, as it was decades ago about gay marriage. You know, this is, you know, about people's livelihood, trans and gender diverse folks' livelihood. And I just can't sit by as a member of the community, let alone, you know, an ally, and stay silent. And, you know, not everyone can be as active, and that's certainly not the call to action. The call to action is something. Try something, have a conversation, put a lawn sign up, and hopefully, you know, we can all do our part bit by bit.
Walk us through how you can get a lawn sign and how you can be a part of this movement.
On our social media right now on Instagram, and it's going to be up on our website shortly at pflagyork.ca, you'll be able to register through a Google form. Just fill it out. We just need to know some basic information and for you to acknowledge some information for now about how to pick up the lawn sign. We're looking to see where they're going to be as well in York Region. If you're outside the region, we can make some other arrangements. But also, this is nationwide as well. Wherever you're listening to this, connect with your local PFLAG chapter. All PFLAG chapters across the country are going to be doing this, and we're very happy to be spearheading it here in York Region.
Those who are subjected to what you're calling anti-trans rhetoric, how does that feel? How does it feel to hear that?
It can feel like the world is imploding on you and that we're going back in time, and it can feel lonely. And that's why it's important for our allies to be as visible as possible, whether it's writing a letter, whether it's reaching out to someone, whether it's having a conversation with your friends and peers, or whether it's standing up to issues or conversations that you hear that just don't meet your own expectations of inclusion and diversity. That's what this is all about. It's about making people feel that they are included in society just like everyone else, and everyone is deserving of that. And I would hope that the folks listening to this today who have been impacted by this anti-trans rhetoric, whether you're a member of the community, whether you're an ally, whether you have a family friend or a child who is impacted by this, that you know that we're in this together, and we just need to find ways to come together, and hopefully this can be one of them.
It is a very powerful call to action. Thank you, Tristan Kuhlman, PFLAG York Region's president.
Thank you very much, Anne.
After the break, the city of Kingston prepares for Monday's eclipse. That story is next on The Feed. We'll be right back.
Do you have a story idea for The Feed?
Call us at 416-335-1059 or email info@1059theregion.com. Ann Rohmer and more of The Feed coming up. This is 1059 The Region.
Welcome back to The Feed. I'm Ann Rohmer. This Monday, a once-in-a-lifetime event is taking place, a total solar eclipse of the moon passing between the Earth and the sun. Glenn Perkins with one of the best viewing locations to witness this event.
You would need to be directly along the solar eclipse's specific path to see the full effect. Totality will just miss Toronto, but will be visible in Hamilton, St. Catharines, and Niagara Falls. Kingston will see the longest eclipse of more than 3 minutes. Brian Patterson is Mayor of Kingston, and he joins us now. Mayor Patterson, welcome to The Feed.
Well, thank you. Great to be here.
What's the buzz in your city right now?
Certainly over the last few weeks, interest has really started to spike. Everyone is talking about it, not only about looking forward to the eclipse, but also just what to expect, what it will be like in the city that day. We're expecting that we'll be joined by lots of visitors and tourists, and obviously everyone here in the city is excited to experience something that really, you know, won't occur again for probably been another 400 years.
Communities along the path of the solar eclipse are anticipating large crowds. What kind of numbers are you estimating for Kingston?
That's a great question, and probably one of the trickiest parts of this. It really is a very wide range. So I've seen estimates in the range of maybe 30 to 40,000 people and all the way up to several hundred thousand people. So it's a very wide range. It's very difficult to predict. We are anticipating and planning for a large number of people to arrive, and certainly we know at the end of the day it's going to depend on weather conditions. You know, will we have clear skies, and also relative to other spots along the path, you know, how does Kingston, you know, measure up? So we're expecting and really encouraging people that are interested in coming to come early. To come, even just, you know, make a, if you can, there's still some hotel spaces available. Come spend the weekend, you know, so come early and leave late. We think that that's probably best, but at the end of the day, we do know some people will make their decision the day of about whether or not to make the drive in to see the eclipse.
How do you prepare for something like this? I'm thinking back to when the Tragically Hip played in Kingston. There was something like 20,000 people in Spring Market Square. What was learned from that?
That's probably our best template, to be honest, about how to host and prepare and welcome thousands of guests. The number that we were working at then was a little over, you know, with everyone in the concert in the square and the concert as a whole, probably about 30,000 people. So this might be in that same range. I think there's really a few things we're looking at. First, what we're trying to do is set up different viewing areas in different parts of the city. So really trying to spread out crowds. I think that the biggest challenge would be if everyone just tried to come to one particular location. So we're setting up different viewing areas with, you know, food trucks and washrooms and, you know, hoping that that will help to distribute. We're also going to make transit free that particular day. So if people want to, you know, whether you're in Kingston or just coming to Kingston to just park somewhere and then use transit to be able to get in and around, we think that that's probably going to help as well. And then ultimately, it's just one of those events where you have all hands on deck. So obviously, all of our emergency services personnel and other community ambassadors and myself will be there and ready to assist and help as needed.
You mentioned ensuring safety for the people coming to your city. Let's talk about policing. What kind of preparations are required there?
You know, there's a couple of things that we obviously want to ensure. One is that with an enormous number of people, if there is a much higher level of traffic, just making sure that, for example, that anybody experiencing a medical emergency, that there's still a clear path to the hospital. And ultimately just helping to have communication ready, that just be patient. So it's likely that on Monday afternoon of April the 8th that it's going to be, things will be slower with that much traffic volume. And so just letting people know to anticipate that, to be patient, to be prepared, and we're as much as possible, again, to come early and to leave late to try to avoid a big traffic rush either right before or right after the eclipse.
For the businesses in Kingston, this is a great opportunity for them.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, we're certainly embracing it as a special moment and looking forward to taking full advantage. Typically, the full tourist season in Kingston doesn't really take off usually until about the middle of May. And so obviously we're opening up early, certainly for this. So you're going to see just about all of our tourist sites. And of course, our restaurants, hotels, everything will be basically a full steam ahead for not just on Eclipse Day, but certainly the weekend and the days both before and after. And we're looking forward to celebrating together and looking forward to hosting those that might want to make a weekend getaway out of this.
Preparation is definitely the key. Queen's University has an Eclipse Task Force and started preparing in 2021. What kind of partnership is there between the city and university?
Yeah, the university has been a great partner with us on this. And so, for example, they've been distributing free eclipse glasses for April the 8th throughout the community, which has been great. And obviously just helping with the education, helping people to understand what to expect on the day. So, you know, this is definitely a community event. So although the city itself is organizing, you know, some of the logistics around the viewing sites and the traffic flow, ultimately it's great to have community partners that can help to add in other pieces to make it what I know is going to be a memorable day.
You mentioned earlier about those viewing sites. Where will you be?
So that's a great question. I already have some scheduling obligations that will take me right here to downtown. So I expect that I'm going to be in or around City Hall, so right in the heart of the downtown, with I'm sure many, many other people as well. And I'm looking forward to it. I mean, as much as I'm looking forward to seeing the eclipse, I'm also looking forward to the experience of both residents and visitors all kind of gathering together down here on the waterfront of the downtown or in the downtown core itself. So I will be right in the middle of the crowd, looking up at the sky like everybody else.
And there's always room for one more.
There is absolutely room for one more. And, you know, again, it's difficult to know exactly how many people will be joining us, but we're all doing our best and working hard here to make sure that all plans are in place. And I think it'll be a great moment.
Brian Patterson, Mayor of Kingston, thank you for joining us on The Feed today.
Thanks very much.
When we come back, healthy spending habits. This is The Feed on 105.9 The Region. Please stay with us.
Follow us on Twitter at 105.9 The Region. Ann Romer and more of The Feed after the break. This is 105.9 The Region.
Welcome back. I'm Ann Romer. Next on The Feed, tips to set financial goals that work for you. Shaliza Backus with that story.
Tax season is upon us, and it may not always be so easy to have those financial conversations, especially with your partner. So to help us do that, I am joined by author of The Wisest Investment and financial expert, Robin Taub. How are you?
I'm great, thanks, Shaliza. You?
I'm great. Thank you so much for joining us. Okay, it's tax season, and this is the time of year where people are kind of freaking out a little bit about their finances. How do you, before you get into the conversation about your actual finances, how can we calm them down a little bit?
I mean, we do have to file, and there is a deadline of April 30th, so I understand why people are feeling a little bit anxious about it. But tax season is a really great excuse to review your finances. As you're going through your return, you're going to see how much you made in 2023 and what deductions or credits you can claim and how much money you're hopefully getting back as a refund or what you owe. So it's also a really great opportunity to plan forward and think about how much are you going to make in 2024 and, you know, what can you spend, and also to reassess whether the tools that you're using, like your everyday bank account, are working for you in terms of the cost and the benefit. So you might be getting money back, so maybe that's the thing that you need to focus on to calm down and just, you know, get it done.
That's actually some really good advice. And, you know, a lot of families and couples are really struggling right now. You know, inflation is wild, and a lot of people who may not have been living paycheck to paycheck before are in that situation now. So what are some tips to manage finances when it comes to your entire family?
Times have been challenging for people, but I think, you know, in terms of partners in a relationship, in a family, it's really important to talk about money early and often with your partner. And PC Financial recently did a survey, and it found that 4 in 10 couples wish that they talked about money with their partner earlier in their relationship and that they have had more frequent discussions. The survey also found that Canadians who talk about their finances weekly are happier and more satisfied in their relationships than those who discuss money less than once a month. So it's really important to talk about it, especially when, your budget is tight. You want to make sure you're prioritizing your spending on the things that are most important, to the family.
Well, that's interesting. Not only are we getting financial advice, but we're getting relationship advice as well, Robin. So how do we go about these conversations? And it's probably a little more difficult for newer couples compared to people who've been together for years and years, but how can we ease into it and avoid fights, really?
I mean, it's going to be different if you're in a long-term committed relationship versus if you just started dating. But I think to get on the right foot, it's really important to be open and transparent about your finances, because being honest about money in a relationship, it does build trust and improves the relationship satisfaction. You can talk about what you own and what you owe. So, the difference being your net worth. You can talk about the money coming in from your earnings and the money going out for your expenses, which is your budget or your cash flow. And together with your partner, it's important to figure out if your bank accounts and the other financial tools are working for you by looking at their costs and benefits. And for example, the PC Money account is a no monthly fee account, a bank account that lets you earn PC Optimum points on everyday banking, like payroll deposits and bill payments, and of course on spending wherever you happen to shop. So just making sure that, the tools that you use are working for you.
And it's also interesting that you bring up the PC Optimum program, because I feel like we need to be saving money and earning points towards things as much as we can. So is that helpful to save money as well?
Yes, because the PC Optimum points that you earn can be redeemed on all sorts of everyday purchases and necessities. It's helping you reduce the amount that you're spending when you redeem these points. You know, for a lot of families right now, that can make a difference. Like every dollar counts right now. It's really important to get a handle on your budget and what you're spending, what's coming in, and to use the tools that will really help you optimize your situation.
You touched on this a little bit about how to really prioritize where to be spending your money, but do you have any specific budgeting tips? And maybe there are some things that we could cut back on?
I do encourage families and individuals as well to really think about their values, their personal values, the things in life that are most important to them, and use that as a framework to help guide and prioritize financial decisions. Because usually, money is a scarce resource and we don't always have enough to get everything that we need and want. So using your values and discovering what those are is a really great first step. And then using those values to set goals and with your partner to try and get on the same page financially so that you can work together to achieve those goals.
What about the lone wolves? What about the people who aren't in relationships, don't necessarily need to be having budgeting conversations with another person, but they maybe need to be having them with themselves?
Oh, that's so true. Like, it just complicates things in a way when, when you're in a partnership, because you do have to work together as opposed to against one another. It's a little simpler when you're just looking after your own finances, but you still have to prioritize it, set aside some time either each week or each month to just review your spending, get a handle on what's coming in and what's going out, because a lot of people find staying on top of their bills can feel a bit overwhelming. And again, the PC Money account that I mentioned before, it lets you pay your monthly bills like internet and utilities, and also set up recurring bill payments if that's more convenient for you. But you're always earning those PC Optimum points when you're doing this type of everyday banking. Even as an individual, I think we're still trying to make sure that every dollar counts.
Well, that is definitely the take home. Every dollar does indeed count. And Robin, if our listeners want to get some more information or find some more advice from you or from PC Financial, where can we go?
For more information on the PC Money account or about the survey, please check out pcfinancial.ca. And to learn more about myself and my book, The Wisest Investment, you can go to robintaube.com. So that's Robin with an I and T-A-U-B.com.
Amazing. Robin Taube, financial expert and author of The Wisest Investment. Thank you so much for joining us and happy tax season.
Thanks, Aliza. You too.
If you missed any part of the feed, please go to 1059theregion.com or wherever you get your favorite podcast, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and Audible. I'm Ann Rohmer. Thank you so much for listening.